Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you very much. As I see in the program, it says 12:30 lunch. Now it's 10 to 1. So I think I have 2 minutes. But I got a little less, so I take one for the team and try to be quick, even though I'm trying to build up an argument, and this is going to be challenging, so bear with me. We have to now work together. What I'm going to do now, and this is actually quite neat, because I'm not diving into the common law, civil law divide Judge Prichambeau just laid out in much detail, so I can build on his presentation. And what I'm mainly doing is I'm talking about the use within judicial decision making of these two categories, common law and civil law. And you will see that this is quite interesting how it is used and how important the use is. I'm going to focus on the International Criminal Court as the permanent International Criminal Court. So this entire presentation had three parts. I'm going to be very quick. The first one is empirical. I'm going to show you how these two categories are used. The second one is analytical. I'm trying to show you where in legal theory, like in legal argumentation, the two categories are used, and the third one is normative, and by telling you how it could be better used. There's a little anecdote. I was working at the International Criminal Court as a visiting professional at the Appeals Chamber. At my first day, actually, I got an assignment from a legal officer, and actually Judge Prichambeau just hinted at it. The legal officers were mainly common law dominated at the Appeals Chamber. So I got this assignment, and I was asked how long I would need to finish it. I said, well, probably 1.5 or 2 days. And she looked at me and said, well, I wanted to give you a week or two, because you have to be careful. We are making law here. And I said, no, you don't, because at the International Criminal Court, you don't have precedent. So basically, the Appeals Chamber, at least when it comes to the sources, Article 21, is not making law other than appeals chambers in common law jurisdictions. She got really angry at me. She never wanted to work with me again, actually. And I ended up working with Judge Monaghan, which was actually a pleasure, so it turned out to be very nice. So I'm going to show you that this makes a huge difference how you use common law and civil law divide, and that actually what Judge Prichambeau said, that it makes also a difference in how you think and how you render judgments. Judge Prichambeau just hinted at this one decision of the appeals of the trial chamber, and there's a dissenting opinion of Judge Henderson where he said the following: the Rome Statute provides for key aspects of the proceeding to be conducted in an adversarial nature. Now, what I'm going to do during my presentation, I sometimes equate adversarial and inquisitorial with the categories common law and civil law. This is done very often. It is not quite correct, but it is still done very often, so it does a trick. Another quote from the Appeals Chamber is, the Appeals Chamber recalls that the court's legal framework combines elements from the common law and the Romano-Germanic legal traditions. So obviously the Appeals Chamber disagrees with the analysis or the remark of Judge Henderson. In a book of Teres Romano and Zwiegert, the international judge, there's an anonymous former ICCY judge who said the conflict between civil law and common law is overrated. So, but is it really? Is it really overrated, or is it absolutely existential when it comes to legal decision making? It cannot be overrated. See the fourth quote, where in Bemba, I think it was the pre-trial chamber, said the search for truth is the principal goal of the court as a whole, including the pre-trial chamber. Another pre-trial chamber judgment: the pre-trial chamber is not a finder of truth. This is essential. So if you think you're a finder of truth, you do different things as a judge than when you think you're not a finder of truth. The evidential standards are different, and so on. So this is actually vital. I'm going to show you, and this is where I skip a little. When you use the word adversarial, and again, I equate it with common law, there are five different meanings of it. It's the same with common law. It can have the traditional meaning as juxtaposed to inquisitorial, or common law juxtaposed to civil law. This is more a descriptive meaning. I describe something and I describe two opposite sides. I have a second meaning. This is the theoretical model, which is also descriptive, describing the goal of a certain process, the goal of common law and the goal of civil law. A third one is a pure procedural type, capturing the characteristic features of the common law process, for example. And we also call it the lowest common denominator approach. And there is an ideal of procedure. This is used very often in American criminal procedure, when you label concrete criminal procedure as closer to or farther to an ideal type, which is more normative. Or third, or last but not least, a historical meaning, when you actually refer, for example, to civil law as something which happened or which was there during the Napoleonic time, when we still had a quite severe inquest and common law, which protects the rights of the accused. I wanted to show you something which is usually done in American courts, and there you can already see that the common law civil law dichotomy is used as an argument within decision making, as a very important argument. When in Miranda, very important case, it was explained that the privilege against self-incrimination must be protected from the time of arrest, because it is at this point that our adversary system. So we describe, or what the judges did was they described their system as being adversarial of criminal proceeding, distinguishing it, now a different meaning of it, distinguishing it at the outside from the inquisitorial system. So this is already an argument hinting at an internal system of beliefs and values. And they take this internal system of beliefs and values as an argument to structure their argument and to interpret a certain rule or to interpret certain case law. Judge Scalia in Blakely versus Washington stressed that the framers' paradigm of criminal justice rejected civil law traditions. So it was very important for him to stress that in favor of the common law ideal of limited state power accomplished by strict division of authority between judge and jury. So this seems to be the common law ideal, the division of power between judge and jury. But the thing is, and this is actually something Damashka developed, if you have a controversy between parties, this can be decided between professional judges on the one hand, or by lay judges on the other hand. That does not render it common law or civil law. A contest can be written or orally. Many people think once it's written, it's civil law, once it's orally, it's common law. But this is actually not the truth. Adversaries can argue before a single level of authority or several levels of authority. This all is very important when you analyze criminal procedure, and the dichotomy, common law and civil law, doesn't capture it at all. But still, as you saw in the on the quotes, it is still very much used as an argument and in decision making. And I very often use the example of, I don't know whether you're familiar with musical theory, an enharmonic equivalent. If anyone is here who knows what that is, that is, you have a note on the piano, and actually, let's say you have C sharp and D flat. It's the same note, basically, but it's called different. Why is it called different? Because it's actually within a different key. So it tells us something completely different, even though we have the same note. The same holds true with regard to certain procedural elements. For example, we have disclosure and plea bargaining. If you take plea bargaining, many people say this is a common law element. It does not necessarily have to be a common law element. We introduced it in Germany, and plea bargaining in Germany has many requirements which common law countries do not have. For example, the judge has to agree upon it. It always needs to be written. Very strict requirements which actually turn plea bargaining into something, if you want to call it, civil law. So it's not a common law element anymore. So it has no argumentative authority. My intermediate conclusion, I run through it, my intermediate conclusion is that the common law civil law dichotomy is mainly used descriptively as a systematic argument to justify the interpretation of a procedural rule. Well, this is very important. So it is an argument to justify the interpretation of a procedural rule. And I can tell you how. If you have a procedural rule and you don't know how to interpret it, you have several arguments to actually, or several modes of interpretation, how you can find out what this procedural rule, this lacuna probably in the procedural rule, can tell us. There are two kinds of systems, the external system and the internal system, when you have a systematic argument. The external system is very often the position of the rule within the statute, the preceding or subsequent rules, or the official title of the rule or the clause within the rule. I'll give you an example. There was an argument in, I think it was Bemba who made the argument that he wanted to be provisionally released during deliberations. Very clever, actually, because his lawyers argued that that he had to be released because the case was finished and the trial was finished, because deliberations didn't belong to the trial anymore. But who would provisionally release Bemba in order to ask him, could you please come back for the judgment? So this is not really going to happen. So the judges argued, well, yes, but deliberations in the statute, in the Rome Statute, were under the heading trial. So they used an external systematic argument to actually justify or reject his provisional release. The dichotomy common law and civil law has nothing to do with the external system. It is more the internal system. Because when we say in legal theory, we have to have a consistent system of values and norms, which is an ideal. This is the reference point. So you always have to have a certain consistency when you make a certain decision. So you would use the dichotomy common law and civil law to justify a certain decision and to say, well, now we are consistent, for example, because we are a common law system or we are a civil law system. Now it looks more complicated as it actually is. Suppose you have a society, these are the values and norms in the society. I have given you the interpretation. Germany, this is like representative for interpretation in civil law system. The parliamentary legislator tries to capture these values and norms. And in order to actually see these values and norms, you have different modes of interpretation, the grammatical, historical, systematic, or the ratio and purpose interpretation, what we call teleological interpretation. In common law system, this is quite different. And imagine you have a common law judge at an international tribunal, because the written code has not the same position as it has in a civil law system. So the values and norms of a society can be captured by both the parliamentary legislator and by the lawgiver, the courts. So we have several kinds of interpretation. If we interpret the statute, we have mainly the literal rule. We also have systematic arguments and purpose arguments. And when we have the courts, we have the stare decisis, so the binding precedent. This is very important because this influences how you interpret statutes. Bear in mind that, for example, at the International Criminal Court, you don't have precedent. I'm going to show you this in a minute. But this has a huge impact on how you would interpret something. But common law judges are not always aware of that. And that's why they give the literal rule much more importance than civil law judges would do in a parallel case. So I skip this. That's why in a civil law country, if you looked at the statute, you will have realized this, that the rules are usually much more abstract and much more general, less concrete than in a common law country, because in a common law jurisdiction, you also have the case law. So what you would do in a common law jurisdiction, I skip this, the rules are much more concrete and precise. And what you would do if you wanted to interpret something in Germany, for example, a judge would always use a certain method of interpretation in order to cope with the values. I'm going to show you in a minute what happens if the legislator wanted to introduce a certain value which would not be in line with the values of the society. The International Criminal Court has a different institutional context than national jurisdictions, saying it does not really have a legislator. You could say the Assembly of States parties or even the UN, but the International Criminal Court is not part of the UN. It has constructive ambiguity. We had a Rome conference where many state parties were present. They all had to reach a compromise, and this you can see in the rules of procedure and evidence. So, for example, things like hearsay or things like examination in chief and cross-examination, words like this do not appear in the rules of procedure and evidence because we wanted to avoid them. Also, the case file, the word case file or dossier does not appear because there was disagreement whether we have something like that at the International Criminal Court or not. We have an unclear definition of a system. We don't have a homogeneous set of beliefs and values because there are several states taking part in this. Procedural rules usually have are subject to retroactivity. So it's not the same as substantial rules. At the International Criminal Court, this is a little different, but usually this is the case, and we have a different background of the decision makers. So what happens when you, and I'm going to come to the International Criminal Court decision making process in a second, what happens if you introduce, you see that in the blue dots, if you introduce an element which is alien to a system? Now, in common law systems, usually the courts would react, and the courts would try to see what the values of the society are and whether it's worth actually to take into account new values, new procedural elements, or whether the courts have to correct what the parliamentary legislature did. This happened actually, I think, Gregory could correct me, in the US in the 50s, 60s with the Supreme Court, there was a kind of a backlash, there was kind of a communication between the Supreme Court and Congress, and they tried to correct themselves every time the court did something or Congress did something. Now,
The Warren Court,
that's what I mean. So that's why we still very much restrict the interpretation of statute, and we say, well, we apply the literal rule because the statutes are quite concrete and precise. This is different, again, just an example in Germany, but it could probably apply to other civil law countries in a civil law country, because courts do not have this possibility of making law. That's why the judges have more methods of interpretation, and they very often statistically use the systematic and the teleological interpretation, the purpose approach. So they try to correct the parliamentary legislature by actually trying to see what are the society values and norms, and how can I somehow correct what the parliament just did, and we think that is wrong. You can think that is probably actually a violation of the separation of powers. We have this discussion, for example, in Germany, but it's still the case. At the ICC, you do not have that. So you do not have a homogeneous society. You do not really have parliamentary legislature. You have constructive ambiguity. You don't have precedent. So this is our situation at the ICC. Right. So what do judges have to do? They almost have to do the impossible. They have to do this. So it's them who have to create this system. who have to establish a system which is somehow consistent, which has consistent values and norms, because no one did. And this renders the common law, civil law dichotomy unsuitable from a descriptive perspective. Because what do you want to describe? You can describe certain features, but it says nothing. And you cannot certainly use it as an argument. So you need a model. You need a model that is much better suited to actually grasp the specific institutional and cultural context. Tell me how many minutes? 5 minutes do I have? So you need to grasp that. And that's why you need an ideal type procedural model, and you measure everything against it. Mirjam Damashka said, in the Faces of Justice, the music of the law changes, so to speak, when the musical instruments and the players are no longer the same. There are some Italians here in the rooms. We are in Italy. In 1989, there was a procedural reform introducing lots of common law adversarial elements. This created problems because the institutions still acted in a fairly civil law inquisitorial manner. And this same is happening at the ICC. And interestingly, I just wrote something about the new Kosovo tribunal. We have a huge problem there because we have a fairly American prosecutor. We have mainly civil law judges. And eventually, this will come to a huge problem. This will create a huge problem. So if we have a systematic interpretation of the rules of procedure and evidence, we have to develop, and I can't go into much detail, this is a shame because this is one of the conference's overriding objectives, Weberian ideal types that only give us guidance, and we have to measure everything what we want to decide against it. We have to do comparative modeling of these ideal types as a macro comparison, and we have to identify certain general principles. So I come to an end. It is an evergreen to use common law and civil law as a dichotomy in international criminal procedure, and actually usually no one wants to hear about it. The thing is, it is not just that we use it and no one cares. Many judges use it as an argument to underline their interpretation. As long as they don't do that, that's okay. But if they do it, they should do it properly. And they should not do it, use it as just describing certain features because it has no argument force. Instead, they should, apart from everything else they do, because they are totally not busy, they should create this systematic framework of an internal system, and they can do this by using common law, civil law as an ideal type or using something completely different. There are 7 or 8 models out there to model international criminal procedure, but somehow we ended up with this civil law, common law, or adversarial inquisitorial divide, and this became, I always describe it as an emoji. It's nothing more, nothing less. It tells us something. You can actually highly misunderstand emojis. It tells us something and it tells us nothing. So what we do have to do is, in the future is to be a little bit more accurate. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.